His legs are gone, or at least he can't feel them. And then he is weightless. Every last inch of his being in unimaginable pain, the strength of his mangled arms failing. He looks down at his chest to see the glittering black spine of a long tail protruding from his ribcage. Oh, he thinks, the world growing dim. The big fucker impaled me. Shock spares him the feeling of the creature's tongue digging into the back of his head as if he's an overripe melon. 15. Escape clause.
Oh my God. They're opening the door. Do you hear it?
Anne whispers in the darkened maintenance bay.
We're going to get rescued.
He hears it as well. The distinct thunk of the 12-pin vault door leading into the kennels. The motors will soon swing it wide, allowing all of the creatures to spill out into the skiff. The only question that remains in his mind is, why? What's their plan? As if in answer, the few lights inside the closet flicker, and the most awful grinding sound echoes through the station ventilation shafts. Alert, Titus says, his nasal voice echoing through the corridors. Scrubbers offline. Life support systems critical. All crew to evac stations. Dorian's eyes lock with Anne's. Alert, Titus says, and Dorian thinks it will be a repeat of the same warning. He's wrong. Orbital dynamics and navigation critical. All crew to evac stations. The two of them hunker down as the banging of talons sounds through the corridor. The creatures stampede through the hallways like a herd, skittering past the closed door of Dorian and Anne's hiding spot. Alert, Juno says, her voice a breathy contrast to Titus's. Access control systems critical. Alert, Titus interrupts. Security and quarantine systems offline. Killbox offline. All crew report to evac stations.
What the ever-loving fuck?
Anne whispers. Silver smile, Dorian replies. That's the only thing that could pick apart station security like this.
It couldn't jump the air gap. Those two networks aren't connected.
That means we've got a saboteur. Or an idiot, Dorian says. My money is on the... Deafening pulse rifle fire fills their ears. Anne throws Dorian to the ground, shoving his cheek against the rough deck. Before he can ask why, a shot ricochets through the bulkhead.
Fucking Christ, Cardozo, she says. Okay, Dorian, we're going to have to move perpendicular to the swarm. That's caseless, armor-piercing ammo he's firing.
He's going to breach the hull, Dorian slurs, and she lets him up.
Not if he fires directly into the guts of the skiff. Lots of layers between him and the outer hull.
He could have used the guns from the armory. Anne looks him over for a moment.
Those are just a placebo. They'll kill a human just fine, but forget about a snatcher. We put them there so Blue's lab assistants would go inside.
On the one hand, Dorian is enraged that no one shared this fact with him. On the other, it makes the creatures all the more perfect. They're gods among men. Or perhaps the children of the heavens, patient and cruel, and always capable of escape. He needs to continue where Blue left off. Some people devote their lives to ship design or architecture. He could be the champion of these majestic beasts. We have to get those data drives and get to the Athenian, he says, and Anne balks.
Are you stupid? An all-points crew evac means exactly that.
He starts to protest, and she slaps him so hard he tastes blood. Then she puts up a finger, cutting off any response.
Don't you fuck around with our lives here, Dorian. We evac ASAP.
No one has ever slapped him before, and the urge to retaliate is instantaneous. Heat rises in his breast, and he sucks in a breath. He wants to strike her back, to break her against the bulkhead and wrap his hands around her slender throat. He wants to crush her fucking skull. But then he remembers their wild sex and thinks better of it. He has muscle, but she's so much tougher with years of combat training. She'd overpower him without any real difficulty. Fighting is her second nature. The screams of the creatures and the sound of rifle fire have died down, retreating toward the central strut. "We're going to discuss this when we get back to the ship," he whispers.
"What? Are you going to fire me some more?"
She rises to a low crouch and grabs him by the wrist. He smirks. "Maybe you can get your job back." She glances back at him, surprised at his pass, but not disgusted. She guides him out into the hallway and toward the kennel's vault door, hunkering down as she moves. He follows, his bare feet sticking to the waxy floor. His suit trousers constrict his movements, and he desperately wishes for a set of fatigues like Anne's. He's dressed to impress, not circumnavigate rifle fire while hiding from unstoppable killing machines. At the last armory, she stops to pick up a couple of smoke grenades and flashbangs. They're surprisingly small, and she fits the bandolier around her waist. Dorian pulls out his pistol, and she touches his hand, shaking her head.
"Put that back. We're only going to get people killed with it, and it's loud."
She taps the grenades.
"These, however, are useful."
He considers arguing that those people might be his targets, and decides against it. He hates the way she talks down to him so confidently, as though he's a child. He'll make her regret hitting him. She's wrong to underestimate him.
"Okay," he says, nodding at the vault door. "You take point, soldier."
Is she disgusted with his ungentlemanly suggestion? It doesn't matter. She's the one with the training, and chivalry be damned. She rushes from corner to corner, and he mimics her movements, sidling up to each one, then glancing out before ducking back to cover. The hissing and rifle fire grow louder again. Dorian and Anne reach the vault door and sneak across the threshold. What they see is nothing like the polished science center from before. Bullet holes snake through the walls. Warning strobes flash white between pulses of red. The clean light of Juno's glass cage sputters like a dying candle. Broken bits of steel litter the deck, and blood drips from a catwalk onto a gory mess. Dorian hopes it's Lucy. He doesn't know the others well enough to care about their fates. He smells it before he sees it. A melted hole in the deck plates, about the size of a human. It stinks of rotten eggs, with a piercing sour note, as though someone is pushing a needle into his nose. Dorian gives it a wide berth as he tiptoes, barefoot, around it.
"What the fuck is that?" he whispers. "Commander Cardozo must have gotten one of them. Remember the acid for blood?"
She pulls one of the flashbangs from her bandolier.
"Just make sure you steer clear when a snatcher goes down."
"Yeah, no problem." He peers over the edge into the hole, which descends two decks down. One of the beasts lies shattered at the bottom. Bilious yellow blood hisses on the floor, spreading from its corpse like drops of water on a hot frying pan. He remembers reading Mackey's design report about how the skiff's exterior decks were super hydrophobic to stop the acid from breaking through. When one of the snatchers is killed, it melts into the floor like a hellbound dragon. Dorian has to admire that. It's almost as if they want to return to the light of Kaufman, to be consumed as thoroughly as they consume. There's something sad about it, too, knowing they're not immortal. He wonders if this is what humanity felt when it experienced the extinction of the wild lion. All reverence aside, he hopes Daniel won't shoot any of the beasts on the central strut. He isn't sure the ship can take a flood of acid in the thinner parts. The pulse rifle fire stops, and Anne rushes ahead. The commander and crew are drawing close to the escape pods. Dorian is just glad that the crew of the Athenian haven't been briefed on the Snatcher threat. The classification level is higher than his crew possesses, and that's a good thing. Otherwise, they'd probably leave without him. He and Anne wind between the various electrical stations and cargo crates. It's clear the crew of the Cold Forge used this open area as a staging ground. While Dorian begrudges them their mess, at least the obstructions provide him with a decent cover. Ahead of them, there's another dark patch, and at first, Dorian thinks it's the next acid crater. Glancing toward Anne, he finds her frozen in place, eyes locked on the ceiling. Following her gaze, he finds one of the aliens wedged in between two coolant pipes, working with deliberate snaps of its jaw to take apart a corpse. The meal is a man, but describing the gender of the thoroughly mangled remains at all seems generous. Past Anne, two long, smooth heads emerge from the darkness, like a pair of players entering the theater stage. The three Snatchers don't react, so they must not yet see Dorian and Anne. He gestures toward the creatures, pointing to his eyes, then behind her. She signals for him to get down. There's a low work table within easy reach, and they roll under it. They could try to go back the way they came, but the escape pods will launch without them. Ahead, there's an unknown number of acid-blooded beasts ready to tear their heads open. Yet it's the only direction toward freedom. Anne pops the compression cap on one of her smoke grenades and hurls it into the distance toward the kennels. It clangs upon the deck before plunging into the melted hole. Only hissing stillness follows the echoing beat. For a moment, Dorian wonders if the creatures heard it. The corpse bangs to the floor in front of him, yielding a splash of blood and a crunch of bone. Its features give nothing away of its former identity. Skin tone, face, and age are all obscured by the deathly slickness of crimson. It takes all of Dorian's concentration not to cry out in surprise. He peers around the corner, just enough to see the outlines of the two exposed beasts. Fluorescent illumination dances across their carapaces, like light shining down a blade. Their faces, such as the rows of teeth can be called, jut toward the yawning crater, patiently watching the yellow smoke as it rolls up from below decks. Dorian wonders if they view things in infrared, sonar, or visual light. A chill rolls down his spine as he considers the X-ray spectrum. Maybe they can see through walls. Were that the case, however, they would have already been eating him. Anne nervously eyes him from her shadowed corner in a stack of crates, the dim reflections of her wide sclera, the only evidence of her presence. She probably wants to know if they've taken the bait. He looks meaningfully behind her to the open space full of deadly claws and teeth and shakes his head no. A heaving thud nearly buckles the table above him, folding its thick steel inward, a hit from another body-sized object. He rolls onto his back and pulls his limbs in tight, tucking all of himself against one side of the workbench. An inky, skeletal tail languidly drips over the side, vertebra by vertebra, until a heavy spine thumps into the deck. There is nothing between the man and the creature, save for a thin layer of rolled steel. And hope. In the light of Juno's cage, he can see the thick cord of muscle operating the whip, and he knows it could tear him asunder with a single hit. This close. The physicality of the thing is intoxicating. In the cages, they looked as though they might be avian-boned, but out here, he senses the heft of its frame. Clawed fingertips wrap around the edges of the table, grasping the edge so the creature can launch itself at a target in the blink of an eye. The beast arranges itself silently on the work surface, passing over it as a ghost. if Dorian grows to old age, he knows this will be the single greatest moment of his life. Anne draws another grenade from her belt, and his heart skips a beat. They're going to hear the rustle of her sleeve as she throws it. They're going to see it bounce off the deck and figure out the direction from which it came. If she tosses that little metal cylinder, it will be the last moment they spend alive. Gingerly removing the compression cap, she looses the grenade. It sails precisely into the acid-cut hole, clinking two decks below before going off with a flash of light and a deafening bang. Dorian's ears ring, and the sound fades into the wild screams of the trio of aliens. They wail with such perfect hatred, such unending rage. The work table goes tumbling off of Dorian as the creature uses it for launch. The snatcher bounds away toward the hole, along with its two compatriots, oblivious to Dorian's now exposed presence. Anne wastes no time and rises to bolt for the door that leads to the central strut. He rolls and gets his feet under him, darting clumsily upright. He'd always considered himself graceful, until he saw the biological murder machines. Together, he and Anne plunge through the malfunctioning station toward the central docking bay, and hopefully, the Athenian. Blue presses her face to the airlock door, peering into the glass to see if she can make out the reason for the pulse fire. She goes to open the interior door, but a flash of instinct changes her mind. She can't simply rush in. She needs to know what's happening. Deep down, she already knows. The comms failure, the warning lights, the staccato blasts of gunfire. The snatchers have broken their containment. She cranes her neck to get a better view of the skiff door. From the airlock module, she can just barely make it out, and it's wide open. In the shadows of the rafters, Marcus's keen eyes decipher the shape of an alien, crawling along the ductwork. Blue pulls the Brain Direct interface helmet from her head, its well-worn straps catching on the stubble of her scalp. Sweat coats every inch of her form, and she's hyperventilating. She has to slow herself down, or she'll choke on her own spit. If they're loose, then where are the alarms? Why didn't the killbox destroy everyone? Her gut seizes as she hears a beep, followed by Titus's computerized voice. Alert. Scrubbers offline. Life support systems critical. All crew to evac stations. What? Blue whispers aloud. Why the fuck is life support failing? Alert, Titus says, and she steels herself. Orbital dynamics and navigation critical. All crew to evac stations. Theoretically, their orbit shouldn't need another injection for another month. But if the calculation systems are down, it might start to degrade immediately. Alert, Titus says. Security and quarantine systems offline. All crew to evac stations. There's shouting in the halls. It's two of the lab techs ransacking the next room, and Blue calls out to them, her voice hoarse and dim. She takes a deeper breath and puts everything she has into it. Hey! I'm in here! Then her larynx contracts, sending her into a fit of violent coughing. The banging in the next room stops for a brief moment, then several sets of footfalls take off. They're moving away from Blue, away from the crew quarters, toward the lifeboats. She knows they heard her. She knows she's been abandoned. Her eyes, already failing, go blurry and wet. She's never been particularly close with the crew. They either dislike her, or they fear her. But they've felt that way since the day they laid eyes on her frail form. She depresses them, because they're too cowardly to confront their own mortalities. God damn you! She screams, not caring whether or not she chokes. The shape of her motorized wheelchair resolves through the starbursts of tears. She shouldn't put herself into it without assistance.
she could fall. One hit to her chest could kill her. She might tear out her stomas. Her ligaments, weakened from vitamin deficiencies and attacks from her own immune system, might snap under the weight of her upright body. But if she doesn't get the hell out of there, the Snatchers are going to make a meal of her. The sensible thing to do is to end it on her terms. There are enough painkillers in her cabinet for everyone on the station to overdose, but the intellijectors read her blood for potential conflicts and toxicology. The syringes would never administer her the dosage she needs. While the computer chips inside them are stupid, the tamper-resistant housings won't let her in without a fight. The oxygen canisters, on the other hand, are an old design and can easily have their valves rigged with a standard-issue pen. Then she remembers Dorian's matches and striker, conveniently tucked away under her mattress. Her great-grandfather burned to death in an oxygen fire on Luna, but before he had the privilege, he lived 3 days in total agony. They tried to freeze him and get him to a treatment center on Earth, but cold sleep was too much for him to bear. That shouldn't be a risk for Blue, though. No one will come to extinguish her. It would take her about a minute to die, but if she seals up the room, she might knock herself out with the concussive force. She could pass her last agonizing moments in blissful ignorance. Or she could admit to herself that she didn't drag her bones to the far side of space just to roast them there. Marcus is still near the egg storage. If she can get to the escape pods, she can instruct him to collect the Prypotin sample and the drives, then seal herself inside to wait. The creatures may be clever, but they won't get in through an airlock door. She'll have to convince the others not to launch, but she can cross that bridge when she comes to it. All that matters is getting that sample. She picks up her portable terminal and unfolds the screen. It still has a charge. She can instruct Marcus via wireless uplink. She doesn't have time to type the painstaking commands just yet. She just needs him to stay alive. Blue, priority one, remain hidden in airlock and await orders. Error, system cannot process the request. Marcus, first priority is rescue and protection of RB-232 survivors. She scoffs. He's protecting the people who would just as soon leave her behind. Blue, can you get me to the escape pods? Marcus, at present there are more pressing demands. Recommend you call out for help. Remain in shelter. I'll come for you ASAP. But he won't have time. They'll launch the escape pods without her. Well, fuck you too. Blue reaches down and clamps her G-tube before disconnecting it. Then she winces as she gently pulls out her catheter tube. Everything is so raw. Those bastards haven't let Marcus come by to replace it and disinfect. She checks the seal on her colostomy bag. It looks nice and tight. Marcus always did a good job locking it down. She swings her legs over the side of her bed, reaching for the ground with her bare toes. Her eyes aren't good enough to perceive depth, so it's like reaching out into a chasm. The mattress is higher off the ground than a normal bed, ostensibly so she can be close to eye level with visitors. She feels stretched to her limit when her right big toe touches the cold surface. Slowly, she eases her weight forward off the mattress. Okay, she says, repeating the word every second to keep the assurances going. Okay. She hasn't stood in over a year. She won't be able to catch herself if she falls. Slowly, she slides down onto her feet, and her ankles lock in place, sustaining her swaying frame. She holds fast to the sheets with a white-knuckled grip, her biceps quivering with every small motion. It's two giant steps to her old chair. She could try to stumble them, falling into her seat, but that seems too risky. To her left, there's a rolling tray where Marcus usually puts her meds. She reaches out with one hand, pulling it to her,
clutching the metal lip to her stomach. To stabilize, Blue throws her other arm across it, leaning her weight onto its wide caster base. Using it like a walker, she traverses the distance on decaying muscle. When she arrives, shaking, at her chair, she tries to orient her rump to the seat. Pulling the tray with her, she moves cautiously until the backs of her knees touch the edge. She goes to sit, and the tray comes out from under her with a heinous clatter, striking the bony top of her bare foot. Pain lights up her leg. That hit will leave a green bruise. Her skin is like an old woman's now, mottling over with the slightest provocation. A bruise isn't going to kill her, however, so it isn't worth worrying about. The only thing that matters is getting her ass to the docking area. The crew quarters module looks like a cyclone went through it. Clothing, gear, and personal effects lie strewn across the deck. Blue wonders what's important enough for people to defy a full evac. Jewelry? Trinkets of another life? Everyone has a fetish, a sentimental object from a time before the Cold Forge, before they became company property. Maybe the Prypotens sample is Blue's fetish object, from a time when she was foolish enough to believe in a cure. Her wheelchair is a stair climber, so the debris poses little threat to her progress, though she has to make sure when she rolls over an article of clothing that it doesn't get tangled up in the wheels. She'd be stuck. That'd be a horrible way to go, done in by an errant shirt. Rolling across the threshold of the crew quarters module, she enters the central strut. Several closed doors block the way, and she's thankful for it. If she saw what lay ahead, she might not be able to make herself proceed. She's just meat in a chair, after all. Easy pickings for the creatures vomiting forth from the skiff. If she hurries, she can barricade herself inside a lifeboat before the creatures spread to the docking area. For the moment, the beasts will be preoccupied with her colleagues. The thought sickens her, but what choice does she have? She must strike while the iron is hot. The central strut looms around her in the red lights of the evac warnings. How far out have the creatures progressed? Every shadow jumps, dancing just beyond Blue's focal plane. She wishes she had glasses, but every prescription she's tried has failed as her optic nerve continues its sclerotic decline. They could be right in front of her, and she'd barely notice. As she passes the lights of the medical bay, she glances inside. Dim, convalescent lights, like a cool summer's night, invite her into its comfortable interior. It's the only salubrious part of the station, probably because the computer can't override the lighting grid and risk damaging patient care. All of the settings in the med bay are manual, at the discretion of doctors. Resting quietly atop one of the beds is Kambili Okoro. There's no blood on his sheets, no snatcher dismembering him in rapturous delight. He's alive and peaceful. Kambili sold her out. He told Dorian where to find the server. For whatever reason, the station has gone to hell, and Blue is 90% certain that Dorian Sudler's arrival had something to do with it. But she blackmailed Kambili. He lost half his face doing something he didn't want any part of. It was her fault. As she watches him sleep, chest rising and falling, the sting of her crewmate's abandonment wells inside. If she leaves him to die, she'll have ditched the last shred of her humanity in this godforsaken place. If she tries to help him, it could kill them both. Motherfucker, she mumbles, steering her wheelchair toward the door. The door shuts after she passes inside, and the medbay's soundproofing kicks in, muffling the klaxons. Inside here, there's a chime, and a pleasant voice says, "Alert. All personnel, please check monitors for urgent messages." The facility supports 10 beds, enough for just under half of the crew. There's a surgical station, but that's rarely been used. The person who needs the most medical attention is Blue, and she gets most of her treatments in her room. Kumbili is one of only two crew members who ever needed a bed. Anne was the other, having fractured a vertebra in a fall. Everyone else just used the med bay for the supplies whenever they had a cold or needed contraception. Anyone still in the skiff wouldn't need a bed. They'd need a tombstone. Blue tries not to think about it. Since the breakup, she's had a lot of practice shutting Anne out of her thoughts. She motors over to Kumbili and reviews his vitals. He's had a few doses of painkillers in the last hour, but she ought to be able to rouse him. Bandages cover the missing half of his face, and his breathing is heavy. Blue reaches up to jostle his shoulder. This is her first time touching him with her own hand. Kumbili is heavier than he ought to be. He stirs, but doesn't open his eyes. "Kumbili," she says, glad it's quiet enough in the med bay for him to hear her. He blinks at her with his good eye, a fugue over his features. He's not as angry as he usually looks, and she realizes it's because he doesn't immediately recognize her. Almost no one sees her human body on a regular basis, and they tend to react with shock at the sight of her. Being outside of Marcus is like being naked before the world.
"You've got to get up, buddy," she says, trying to keep the panic out of her voice.
"Don't buddy me," he slurs, laying back down. "Go fuck yourself."
"Kumbili, wake up."
She jostles him again.
"You have to wake up. Come on, buddy."
He sits up suddenly.
"The fuck did I just say to you, bit?"
"Alert," the pleasant voice says. "All critical systems fault. All crew report to docking area." He squeezes his eyes shut, trying to push through the fog of drugs enough to hear what's being said. Blue knows that feeling all too well.
"I know you hate me, but we've got to go," she says. "You're a dead man if you stay here."
"Where are the others?" he asks, bewildered. Moving with some effort, he swings his legs over the side of the bed and goes tumbling off like a sack of potatoes. His ragdoll arms get under him, and he pushes himself upright. Blood spills down the backs of his hands where the IV needles come loose, and he swears. Lurching to his feet, he starts looking through the shelf for bandages and grabs a package of clotter. Blue considers her answer. The cruel thing would be to tell him the truth, and he might lose his will to flee. She knows all too well by now that fear can equal death.
"They're waiting for us, in the docking area. Come on, get up."
"They left us." Even drugged halfway to oblivion, Kumbili is sharper than most. He stops applying the clotter, letting his bloody hands fall to his sides.
"Focus, Kumbili, and let's work with what we have."
She used that adage with her students a lot, back during her doctoral days.
"We can't stay here. We've got to get to an escape pod."
"Okay." He shakes his head, wincing. "Right. Yeah." He stumbles around the bed toward her, obviously unable to walk in a straight line. She backs up her chair so he can pass, but she doubts he'll make it all the way to the door. He's a fall risk, and if he hits his head, it could be lights out. "Fuck," he says, collapsing to his knees. "Why now?"
"Been asking myself that for a long time."
She rolls past him and stops.
"Grab onto the back of my chair. I'll keep you steady."
He struggles to his feet, and when he puts all of his weight on the handlebars, Blue fears she'll tip over backward. She leans forward as much as her ailing abdominal muscles will allow, and he eases off a bit.
"You ready?" she asks.
"As ever," he replies, steadying himself. She rolls toward the door, and Kumbili takes toddling steps behind. When the medbay door slides open, the cacophony of the cold forge rushes into her ears, momentarily deafening her. Klaxons fill the air. There have to be a dozen different critical alarms sounding, and all systems are under some kind of attack. By their nature, the escape pods must be on their own network, ensuring that a general failure doesn't kill everyone by preventing an escape. Then again, Titus and Juno were supposed to be air-gapped too. So were the Silver Smile servers, and the kennel cells could only be operated by manual control. One system failing is normal. Two systems is unlikely. All systems, and it's sabotage. Will the escape pods even work when they arrive? There's no time to think about that. She just has to take the next right step, and that's getting to the docking bay. Kumbili stumbles along behind her, half pushing so that the motors squeal tiny complaints. If she were alone, she could really open up the throttle. But she made the decision to rescue him, and that's that. Her eyes dart back and forth, searching for the lethal shape of a snatcher, but she finds nothing. Unlike the walls of the kennels, everything in the central strut is an industrial gunmetal gray, polished, welded, and installed without paint. She gets a dozen false positives as her failing eyes scan the scene from large conduits to cooling pipes. Too many objects vaguely resemble the slender shaft of a snatcher skull.
"Why are you so jumpy?" Kumbili shouts over the alarms. "We just need to get to the..."
"Containment failure," she interrupts, coughing, and Kumbili leans in closer.
"What? Like Silver Smile got out again?"
"Yeah," she says into his ear. "And the kennels are open."
Her chair speeds up as he lets go. She spins to face him and finds him bewildered, swaying in the hall, hands by his sides.
"We're fucked," he says. "That's it."
"No, Kumbili. We can salvage this. You just have to..."
He shakes his head no and points down the central strut. Blue turns her chair around to peer into the blurry distance, but she can't see what he's indicating. She knows what's down there. He's pointing at the escape pods, toward the screens of the crew. Interlude. Ken. Nothing interrupts a good time with porno like an all-crew evac. Ken Riley sits in the toilet on board the Athenian when the transmission belts over his intercoms. He waits to see if he heard correctly. Maybe it's a drill. Dorian is off looking at a secret project and shagging the hot security officer, and Ken just keeps the ship ready for launch like a glorified errand boy. Not a lot of pilots would have taken on the posting with Dorian Suttler. It keeps Ken away from home for years at a time. Not that he has much of a home. The post was a convenient way off-world, and Weyland Yutani was willing to be lax in its background checks for qualified star jockeys. Ken owes a lot of people a lot of money, but with a few more missions, those people would all die of old age. The intercom message repeats. It's not a drill. This kills Ken's wood. He wipes, closes up his portable terminal, then dashes out into the mid-deck toward the bridge.
"Gaia! Let's get those engines hot,"
he calls, and the computer acknowledges.
"And open up the docking bay doors. Let me know when the rest of the crew are on board."
The next set of alerts come through, and it sounds like RB-232's computer is having a shit fit. Ken races around the mission planning station as it flickers to life, punching in coordinates and knocking out vectors. Without knowing exactly what's happening to the Cold Forge, though, it's tough to plan. If, for example, RB-232 needs orbital correction assistance, then Ken is obligated to help push.
"New arrival, Navigator Lupia," Gaia says, her smooth voice a balm in the stress. It's going to be okay for Ken, no matter what. They said evac, and he's basically already there. It's hard to get more evac'd than being on a fully operational starship with enough supplies to last 100 years of cold sleep. Sinking into his pilot's chair, he settles his fingers across the controls and chuckles, remembering the old saying at the academy, if a pilot doesn't have his hand on one stick, it's on the other. "What the fuck is going on out there, man?" Montrell says as he rushes in, panting. He's in his casual gear, and must have been hanging out in the crew lounge. The navigator is way out of shape, and he looks to Ken in that moment like a sweaty brown ham. That ham, however, hauled ass, and Ken is appreciative. "I don't know, but these Peckerwoods fucked up something. Like, bad." "Truth," Montrell agrees. "Gonna set up some potential escape vectors." "Already did that," Ken says, winking. "Didn't know you were going to make it." "Thanks, asshole." Montrell mops his brow and plops down at his station by the mission planner. "You know, this better not be a drill, or I swear to God." "You swear nothing. Those evac orders mean you do your job, drill or not. Commander Cardozo would kick your ass up and down the station. Guy looks like he's seen some shit."
"Engines are up to temperature," Gaia announces. "Maneuvering thrusters at nominal pressure."
Ken nods, a stupid habit when talking to a headless user interface. "Thank you, Gaia. Give me hot sticks and snap that docking tube shut when our last two get aboard."
Gaia chimes an acknowledgement. Montrell raises an eyebrow.
"You're going to do this manually?
You've never wanted to do a full burn maneuver away from a station?" Ken asks. "I bet I can make Dorian's eyes bug out."
"New arrival," Gaia says. "Co-pilot Spiteri."
Within seconds, Susan rounds the corner, her cheeks flushed from the run.
"It's chaos out there. Everyone is panicking, acting like it's the end of the world."
"Susie, Susie, Susie," Ken says, sucking his teeth and spinning his chair to face her. "It's the end of a space station, maybe. The world will still be there." She narrows her eyes.
"Fuck you, Ken."
"Gladly, babe."
He folds his hands behind his head, leaning back in his chair. She starts to protest when the back of Ken's chair taps one of the sticks. The Athenian shudders as the maneuvering thrusters fire a short burst. It groans, and a half dozen alarms pierce the bridge. Ken spins back to his console, checking to make sure there's no damage to the docking clamp.
"What the fuck, Ken?" she shouts at him. "You left your shit on manual?"
Montrell mirrors her glare.
"It's the plan, goddammit. As soon as Dorian is on board, we button up and blow this popsicle stand. Now chill, girl."
"Fuck you, you chauvinist prick," she says, sitting down beside him. "This isn't over. Dorian's going to hear about this when the time comes, and..."
"New arrival," Gaia says. "Unknown entity."
Ken grimaces, then calls out,
"Go to your own escape pods, you fucking dumbasses."
They wait, listening to the distant sound of RB-232's alarms.
"New arrival. Unknown entity."
Ken looks across to Susan, then Montrell, then gives them a what-the-fuck-is-it-with-these-people shrug.
"New arrival. Unknown entity."
"Yes, Gaia, we heard you," Ken says.
"Susan, would you please go explain to the jack-offs in our loading bay that we are not their ship, so they can kindly get the fuck out?" Susan unbuckles herself and rises, annoyance flushing her cheeks. It's probably just the evac. As soon as they're coasting in deep space again, she'll be good old Sue. Montrell looks up, almost like a man praying.
"Gaia, is that the same statement three times, or are there three new arrivals?"
"There are three new arrivals," Gaia says.
Ken strokes his mustache.
"Well, it don't much matter,
because they all got to get the hell off the ship. Their escape pods are right next door. Susan, can you do something about that right now? He exaggerates his mouth movements on the last sentence, as though she's deaf. Fuck you, Kenny, she mumbles, headed toward the door. But when she makes it to the threshold, she freezes. A barbed black spine shoots out of her back, extending a full yard into the bridge. At first it looks like Susan's spine simply exploded from her torso, dripping with blood, and Ken struggles to process exactly what he's seeing. The spine is black. Bones aren't black. Why would her spine leave her body? What's with the weird hook thing at the end? It takes him a second to register that whatever happened to Susan Spiteri, she is most definitely dead. A darkness fills the portal around her. Some looming silhouette Ken can't see. Long black talons wrap around her skull. And with a pop and a spray of blood, a tiny mouth emerges from the back of her head. Her body falls, and with it comes a tangle of thrashing, chitinous limbs. It rips into her, nipping at every loose bit of flesh, pulling her apart with the ease of cooked fish. It's four limbs, a torso and hips, a shaft for a skull, and a whipping tail, but this isn't one of God's creatures. It's Satan's vanguard. Both men sit very still, listening to the sea of alarms and the sickening tearing of Susan's blood-moistened flesh. Then Ken remembers the gun. The Athenian does a lot of dirty work for the company, and Ken figured that one of these days some shithead colonist was going to take offense to getting fired and come looking for revenge. His hand creeps under the console, searching for the pistol strapped underneath. He knows he's going to get one shot, so it has to be perfect. The creature's skull is such a long target. Surely a bullet could do enough damage to put it down. His hand finds the walnut grip, and he slides his fingers over the checks, ready to draw. His other hand unbuckles his seatbelt, and he slowly rises, steeling himself to fire. Then Montrell interrupts the beast's blood revelry by deciding to scream. The thing lets out a hiss beyond the malice of any great cat or venomous snake, its lips curling back and body coiling to strike. Ken whips out the pistol and pops off three shots. The bullets hit home, and the beast jumps with each impact, but there's no spray of blood, and it certainly doesn't go down. A glint of silver catches Ken's eye, where one of the bullets pancaked between two of the thing's exposed ribs. Its scream shatters the air as it drops what's left of Susan. Ken raises the pistol to fire again when two more of the creatures come screeching onto the bridge. Fuck, Ken begins, but the U is forever truncated by one of the creatures plunging its claws into his chest, snapping his ribs like a Thanksgiving Day wishbone. Pain, unlike anything he's ever felt, seizes every inch of his body. He can't scream, cannot raise his arms to protect his face against the raw malice dripping from the creature's toothy maw. Most importantly, he cannot unwedge himself from the active joystick underneath him. If Ken's body wasn't failing due to shock, he'd hear the ship crowing with all kinds of alarms. He'd know he was putting the Athenian into a full-burn spiral roll. He'd recognize the shuddering hull and the metallic grind of their docking clamp as it sheared off its mountings, taking a good portion of the docking bay wall with it. Then the ship explosively decompresses to vacuum, silencing everything. 16. Exposure. This is a day of firsts for Blue. It's the first time she's heard gunfire on the station. It's the first time she's realized how much the rest of the crew truly hate her. It's the first time she's considered self-immolation as a viable plan.
It's the first time she's seen a massive hull breach. The Athenian tears loose from its moorings, exposing an oval of space where the docking tube once was. Blue watches through the viewports, staring in horror as the ship scrapes across the row of docked escape pods, stripping them like grains of wheat from a stalk. The temperature plunges. Her ears pop painfully, and she gasps to force air into her lungs. Those two unfortunates nearest the severed tube are sucked away instantly, and she can just barely make out Commander Cardozo hanging onto the deck for dear life. The sirens drown beneath the deafening roar of wind coming from the rest of the station, and she knows she has seconds before the bulkheads seal behind her. The training vids always say go back. Back away, assess your surroundings, close a door, know your escape routes. But when the howling void of the stars gazes directly into Blue's face, it sweeps away all rational thought. The only thing that remains in its place is the primal urge to flee. She turns her chair to leave, but the swirling gale pulls her over, spilling her out onto the deck. Pain rips through her as she strikes an elbow against the metal grate, and blood oozes forth. Blue locks her fingers into the deck, but the grip is feeble, and she knows she won't last long. Looking toward the ceiling, she sees one of the snatchers scrambling toward her, hurtling along the conduits. Despite the breach, it's still primed for murder. Every ounce of her strength is focused on her fingers, and she feels them slipping. She can't run. She can only watch in total paralysis as the creature skitters toward her. It pounces down, claws wide, salivating mouth agape, tail poised to strike. Then the suction grasps it like a small child and carries it toward the tear. Blue watches as it entangles itself in the ripped section of the hull, fighting to come after her. Her fingers begin to slip on the metal, and her wrist aches with the sustained effort. Her head is going light. Her breath comes in short sips. Soon she'll have to let go, and the creature will have a go at her before they both die in deep space. The last finger gives up, and she comes free, but jerks to a halt as Kambili's strong hand wraps around her tiny wrist. He strains with all his might, pulling her until she's even with him, the pain clear in the remains of his face. He's fighting to keep her alive, returning the favor she did him. "Come on!" he screams against the shredding wind. The temperature is almost freezing now. Kambili reaches up to the next handhold and drags her another foot or so. Her shoulder burns in agony. Its damaged tendons can't take much of this. She wants to tell him to drop her, but she can't muster the breath to speak. Ahead of them, warning lights click on, signaling that the safety period is expiring and the bulkhead will seal. It's already closed off the crew quarters and everything further back. They have 10 seconds to get inside, then the bulkhead will repressurize. Kambili strains against the failing oxygen, and the wind begins to slow. They're running out of atmosphere. 5 seconds. With less air, it's easier for Kambili to struggle to his feet and drag her. It's also easier for the creature to come after them. 3 seconds. The oxygen is almost completely gone, and Blue's lungs refuse to fill. The partition grinds toward the floor. 1 second. The snatcher is almost on them, its jaws snapping silently in the thin atmosphere, tail whipping like mad. Kambili shoves her under the partition, falling prone and pushing her as far as he can before it closes. She wants to scream, but there is no air. Her lungs refuse to fill with even the tiniest amount of oxygen. An oxy station down the corridor blares with alert lights, signaling help for those able-bodied enough to get it. But Blue's strength is already beginning to fade, her vision growing dim. She can't muster the power to roll onto her back, much less the wherewithal to walk to the oxy station and don a mask. She rests her head against the deck. Kambili can take it from here. But the blackout never comes, and she hears a hiss, gradually increasing in volume as the deck repressurizes. Her eardrums feel like someone has placed the point of a knife on them, ready to rupture at any second. Her skin is chilled to the bone. The only warm spots on her body are where Kambili's hands still touch her back and leg.
"Kambili?" she moans. "Are you okay?"
She works up the strength to roll away, and finds only a hard steel door where Kambili should have been. A pair of hands is settled into a pool of cooling blood. She glances down to her leg to find one still gripping her, sheared off at the wrist. He's suffocating out there while bleeding to death. She hopes it ends quickly. When she remembers the jaws of the Snatcher, she knows it will. She rolls to one side, tucking herself into a safe niche, then passes out. When she awakes, she has no idea how long she's been unconscious. Half-focused eyes dart around the room, searching for any alien threats, but finding none. If any of the Snatchers was in here with her, she'd already be a pile of ragged flesh. Her breathing gets easier as more atmosphere pours inside. They must not have lost that much pressure, just enough to hurt someone with weak lungs. With trembling hands, she reaches down and gently peels away Kambili's fingers. She puts the severed appendage beside the other, as though that's what she's supposed to do. It makes more sense than anything else she can think of. The alerts have stopped. Titus must have been compromised enough to destroy crew updates. She's not sure how much Silver Smile understands of their network, but if it figures out that they're barely hanging on from damage to the central strut, it might just open all the doors and vent them into the void. If she can get back to her room, she can use Marcus to flash Titus back to Init's state. There's a read-only hard image stored in the server room. She'll kill off Silver Smile and re-image the whole thing. That'll be easier if Javier is still alive, but she doubts he is. The man never seemed spry enough to survive something like this. Then again, neither is she. Blue probably won't be saving anyone. For all she knows, she's the last person left on the station. She might get Titus stabilized, only to discover there's no way for her to get out to the escape pods without a spacesuit. Or maybe all the pods are gone. Certainly the Athenian was destroyed in the chaos she just witnessed. Yet every time she thinks it's over, it isn't. Her life has been like that, ever since the diagnosis. She rolls onto her stomach, and her side of the central strut seems to stretch onward forever into a hazy oblivion. That way lies the med bay, the crew quarters, and her brain-direct interface. She's going to have to crawl on her stomach further than she's ever gone. It's going to fuck up her digestive appliances, and she'll need surgery within the week. She has to try. Blue places one hand in front of her and drags herself forward a few inches. Then another pull moves her a bit more. Two down. A few hundred to go. 17. Flight. Dorian isn't looking the right way when it happens. One minute he's running through the central strut, a pack of Snatchers lurking ahead of them, and the next he's swept from his feet by a blast of wind like he's never felt. It sends him stumbling forward, sprawling across the deck toward Anne. Then he realizes it's not a burst, but a sustained gale-force wind howling down the central strut toward the Athenian. Fuck. He looks as far as he can down the hall to find the station missing a chunk of hull where his ship should have been. Then he sees the Athenian through the viewport, watching as it bangs along the side of the station, knocking loose most of the escape pods. And then his ship is gone. Did it take off, or was it destroyed? He couldn't get a good look. There's a crowd of unfortunates hunkered down close to the